Aye. Very passable, very passable.
Nothing like a good glass of Chateau de Chasselet, eh, Josiah?
Oh, you're right there, Obadiah.
Who'd have thought, 30 years ago, I was sitting there getting bloody lectures. I've gone off script. Who thought 30 years ago we'd all be sitting here drinking Chateau de Chasselet red wine like this stuff?
Aye, in them days, we'd have been glad of a cup of tea.
Cup of tea?
Cup of tea.
Cup of tea.
Before sucking up to a bunch of investors.
I've been cup of tea. You'd be lucky. I used to get glasses of water thrown in my face by irate shareholders who'd had their arms and legs removed by venture capitalists.
That were nothing. We'd write 3 business plans on the way down to London, head over to Mayfair, lick the boots clean of every venture capitalist in Mayfair, get back to King's Cross, pitch to a bunch of drunks, and still get back for a lecture on quantum mechanics.
You were lucky. I used to dream of pitching to drunks at King's Cross. I used to have to pay VCs £150 an hour just to listen to me. And they still wouldn't invest in Abcam.
Now, Abcam, that's a good story. So, thanks for that indulgence, guys. We're going to talk a little bit about opportunities and spotting opportunities, missing opportunities, and taking opportunities. So we almost called this session Spot the Mistake. But that whole session was actually there to say we get very, very deluded about the past, and we rewrite history our own way. And when you hear people, old farts like us, talking about actually what happened, it's never really the truth. So we're going to try by asking each other questions about areas that we actually know something about and we know what happened, that hopefully we'll get into the real nitty-gritty of it, and whether we did have to lick the boots of venture capitalists or pitch to drunks at King's Cross.
The last one.
Or drunk VCs at King's Cross, even. So when thinking about this session, and talking about opportunities, we really came to the fact that there were a set of things about how ideas turn into opportunities and turn into reality. And we thought we'd sort of break those down. And the first, and I'm going to run through them all, and then we'll try and pull them out as we talk a bit further. The first was that ideas are cheap. There are lots and lots of ideas around. David has a view that good ideas are a lot rarer than perhaps I think, but maybe we'll come to that. But actually, it's about ideas becoming something and making them happen that's the key. And actually, the other thing is that all good ideas have their time. We're both very aware that timing is really important in terms of opportunities, and that fashion is important. Maybe more important than it should be, but you have to recognize fashion. There's a time when things are in the air, and there's a time when things are right, and timing is everything. One of the other things we both came up with was that when you actually take ideas and try and turn them into opportunities, what you're doing is stress testing them. And good entrepreneurs and people who have done it several times get very good at stress testing ideas. They talk to colleagues, they talk to potential investors, they talk to their friends, they talk to the people whose views they admire, and they use that to stress test an idea. But very often, actually, the things that restrict an idea are actually current business dogma. And you've got to get quite smart at recognizing when you're being restricted by the conventional thinking of others and business. And finally, we realized that actually in taking an idea forward and turning it into an opportunity, there almost always is a trigger. And very often opportunities don't happen because no trigger occurred to make it happen. And really good people at making ideas turn into opportunities, turn into big opportunities, are very good at both recognizing triggers and very often creating triggers. So those things we're going to talk about. And first of all, I'm going to ask David some questions. I'm going to talk about what I think was probably his first big success, or the one that he was best known for, which was analysis, which I always think of a phenomenal piece of timing, because David managed to establish a consultancy and exit a consultancy, which in itself is quite an art form, and get it right at the peak of the telecoms boom, when the information and knowledge that it had was really valuable. And so I'd like to ask him how analysis happened and whether my view of it was brilliant timing is correct.
Well,
I'm going to drink the Chateau de Chasselet.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I was happy then. Well, the brilliant timing wasn't correct, actually. I mean, go back to analysis. It was I finished my PhD here, and I thought, what am I going to do? And I thought of setting up a consultancy company. But I didn't have enough experience, so I went down to London and worked at the Economist Intelligence Unit for a couple of years, about 2.5. And then I decided that I'd perform analysis. They'd done this thing, the Cambridge phenomenon, and you know, it was all kind of buzzy, so I thought it'd be actually an appropriate place to set up a consultancy. And telecoms was my particular business. And that went along very happily, and we managed to get through the big recession between about 89 and 92, which was really very horrible. And then began that long boom period through the 90s, culminating in the complete madness in 2000 and 2001. And it was complete madness because I didn't really spot it, actually. And this is what about spotting opportunities and spotting areas where you make a mistake. And because I thought I understood the telecoms business in a rational way, and the telecoms business was behaving completely irrationally. It was completely nuts. I mean, there were companies starting up around here and getting fabulous valuations. I mean, there may never be another time like it. It was just absolutely unbelievable. And then, of course, everything ran out of steam in 2001 and everything crashed. Now, if you're a consultancy business, that's a bit of bad news. I mean, we had to make a lot of people redundant, about 70 or so, out of a total staff of about 220, something like that. So it was fairly big, fairly nasty times. What I should have done, Andy, was I should have sold the company in 2000.
At the height of the...
I had people coming along, and they wanted to buy the company, and I thought, no. This I can see a path, because I've had a path for about 15 years. I can see this path, this exponential growth. I know how this stuff works. It's going to be all right. And we just hit this brick wall. Had to make a lot of people redundant. And then, basically, I kind of... It really shocked me. Really, really shocked me. And I sat back, and I thought a couple of things. One was, I needed to get out. And I need to get out because I realized that all that was going to happen in the consultancy business was we'd seen the little blip at the end of the 1990s, the beginning of the end of the 80s and 90s. We'd had that long run and then bang. And all that was going to happen now was another long run and then a bang. So all I was doing then was basically planning the whole of the company to be able to do an exit. And so I reconfigured the company, redid the management, promoted people, sorted out the governance structure internally about how decisions were made, made myself completely dispensable and sold the company in August 2004, which was good timing on the up, but boy, I could have got more than twice as much if I'd actually called it right in 2000.
So timing is really important. And seeing the way, and one of the things you gain with experience is you do see these cycles go forward. And, so, and 2000 was 1999-2000 was amazing.
So the next one, just on that one, I did another one called immediately after the end of 2004. The end of 2004, some old guys who've been working with me. Old guys, I mean, some of my old friends have been working with me. Had pointed somebody else to come and have a chat with me, and they came and had a chat, and then everybody coalesced. And we formed a new company called Three Way Networks. Three Way Networks did femtocells. Femtocells are these tiny little base stations. I think you can now get them from Vodafone. You'll be able to get them from every 3G provider shortly. You plug them into your DSL port, and they give you coverage inside this room or in your house or in your office or whatever else it is. Three-way networks, in its 2.5 years of existence, actually produced, with about probably only about £600,000 or £700,000 worth of investment, probably the world's leading femtocell technology. And it's because it was a small group of engineers who were really knew their stuff. We also had a few rather interesting contacts who bought bits of kit for reasons which I can't tell you about. And the and basically, we were going great guns until we then tried to go up a gear. Mm-hmm. And there were two points where this is about spotting opportunities, but for exit. There were two points here that really hit. One was we got a guy came from Vodafone and said, "I'd like to buy 5,000 of these things from you." That's a lot for a small company. "I'd like to buy 5,000 of these for you because we'd like to do a trial." 24 hours later, he came back and he said, "I've been back to my procurement people. Vodafone cannot buy from any small company. We have to buy from one of five of our big suppliers, and you have to do a deal with one of those five big suppliers, and then they have to supply the stuff to us." Now, the reason why this was the death knell for the company, this was the end of the road. The reason why it was the end of the road was we were already talking to those five suppliers, all of whom were desperate to have femtocells, and they were coming to us for reference designs, which meant, actually, we were already in negotiation, and this was going to be a complication and potentially would put us on the back foot. Simultaneously, we arrived in Barcelona, where they have a great big world congress about all things to do with mobile, right? And the previous year, there'd been really one, maybe two competitors. When we arrived this year, there were more than a dozen. And then some Americans came along and said, "Would you like to partner with us?" And 6 weeks later, we told the company, right? It's calling bank at the right time. But you've had some.
Timing you've triggers. Had some I mean,
what's your best call on timing, Andy?
Well, my best call on... I made a lot of bad calls on time. Well, no, I'll tell you probably what my best call on timing was. Was missing things. Right. So during that time, time of 99 and 2000, when everything got so hot and the world was changing and the dot-com boom was there, and on the life science side, omics was changing the world, but particularly the dot-com boom was there. And I'd exited my first real big exit, which is Carascience, which I'll talk a little bit more about in a minute in the same way that David's talked. And I had a reasonable amount of money, and I was looking at investing things, and I was missing the boat. God, I was missing the boat. Everyone was pouring money into these early stage dot-coms, and I kept meeting people and thinking, this is sort of okay, that doesn't feel right, and I couldn't get in, and I really, really felt I was missing the boat. And when you get that sense, you know, all investors are sheep. And when you get that sense as an investor, I feel it now I recognize it. When you get that sense that everyone is trying to pile into things, that's when you get really, really, really worried. I think it was Warren Buffett who said, "When everyone is greedy, be fearful." When everyone is fearful, be greedy. Yeah, the converse of that. And basically, when everyone is being greedy, you need to be really scared. And at that time, I thought I was missing the boat. And woof, you know, 12 months later, it had all crashed and burned. So that was I probably could have blown everything I had chasing dreams at that stage.
But both of us, Andy, have made most of our money out of biotech.
Yeah, I know. He's made more money out of biotech than I have.
Yeah, but the so
I'm the biotech
so
guru.
There's an issue. There's an issue here about doing stuff that you know about.
Mm.
That you actually deeply, viscerally actually understand. And to do stuff, You know, we both of us seen stuff at Cambridge Angels that people have come along and you go, yeah, that's a good idea, but I really don't quite know enough about this.
Yeah,
it's not really. But chiroscience was a different matter for you. Go on, tell us a bit about
it. Yeah, it was, and it was a great timing. And there was a timing trigger there that was quite that I have such vivid memories of, and so I'll regale that story. So chiroscience came about in 1991 through the demise of a company which was using enzymes to do a whole set of things called enzymatics that had been set up by a very charismatic Welshman called Chris Evans, it was a technical success. It was actually quite a commercial success, but it was a financial disaster, and it was an exit disaster because it was in too many areas that no single person could buy it. And at the time when the financing window, when the financing dried up because they'd had all their investment from a corporate investor who got out of the space, they had nowhere to go. And there was a part of the technology that they had there, which was using enzymes to make chemicals, and particularly handed chemicals. So those of you who are chemists, those who aren't chemists, ignore this. Those who are chemists will know that the handedness is a very important property, and that there's such thing called chirality. And when things get complicated, if you hold this glass up and put a mirror here, you'll see the same glass. If you hold this hand up to the mirror, it's a more complex structure. You'll see this hand, and actually those hands are different. If you try shaking a right hand with a right hand, whilst it's got all the same fingers, the same bits, it can't grip. And that was something that at molecular level was known for years and years and years. And it had been an area that I had looked at academically. It had been an area I'd looked at when I'd become quite a world expert when I was at PA, a technology consultancy, and I'd gone around the world talking about it. I'd helped loads of companies to look at opportunities in this space. And there were opportunities. There was no doubt that pharmaceutical chemistry, medicinal chemistry was getting more complicated, and so was coming up with more things that were handed. People were beginning to recognize that these handed molecules, whilst chemically they seem to be exactly the same, biologically, because biology does everything by grasping, were completely different. They might have beneficial effects and toxic side effects. They might have different, all sorts of different biological effects. And it was something that regulators were beginning more interested in, and the pharmaceutical industry was beginning to say, hang on a minute, we need to be careful here, and we're going to try and make things in single-handed form. And that was an opportunity, but it was a chemistry opportunity. It was helping to solve chemistry problems for pharmaceutical industry that was increasingly trying to make molecules in single-handed form. And at Chiroscience, we had that technology because we pulled it out from enzymatics, which had enzymes, and enzymes are good at making single-handed chemistry. But it was quite clear there was another opportunity. And that came about from the hundreds of drugs that had been developed, which were on the market as mixtures. And technically, scientifically, this made no sense. This was a mixture of two different entities. Well, that's easy. You just take out half the drug and you've got a new drug which may well be more active and better. That doesn't work like that in the pharmaceutical industry because everything is regulated. You cannot sell anything, you cannot develop anything, you cannot invest in anything unless you know what the regulatory path was. And the regulatory path was uncertain. So we'd set up this business called Chiroscience, which was solving chemistry problems for the likes of Glaxo. And we were doing okay, and we were earning revenues. But we knew there was an opportunity that was all about taking those drugs that were on the market as mixtures and redeveloping them in single-handed form where there might be a medical benefit. But there was this great grey cloud over it, which was called uncertainty around the regulatory process. And every time I'd looked at this business, and I'd done it for big companies, small companies, business plans, you came to this point, you had no idea what the investment proposition was. You had no idea whether the entry barrier was high or low. And then I went to a conference in Paris on April 21st, 1993. And it was a thing called the DIA, the Drug Information Agency, and it was the dullest conference. It was full of people, scientists who were talking about very dull stuff around chirality, around HPLC columns and stuff like this. However, what had happened in the background, which none of us knew this was going on, was the world of pharmaceutical regulation was desperately searching for things it could harmonize. They decided they wanted to make pharmaceutical regulation the same in the US, in Europe, and in Japan. And they realized they couldn't harmonize existing regulations because that meant someone had to compromise on something they'd already written down. They had to look at things that were new. And they had decided behind doors that they were going to take the chirality issue and take it as an example for the harmonization of regulations. We didn't know this was going on, and they all decided to meet at this DIA conference. So we're all at this really dull conference, and all these regulators are up in hotel rooms trying to work out what can happen. And on the last day, a lady from the FDA came down with some handwritten overheads and broke into the last talk of the day and said, we've done some thinking, the regulators, and this is what the regulations are going to be. And she put them on the overhead. And most people were sitting there. There were scientists. And I'm sitting there going, this is it. This is it. She defined exactly what was happening. Right? And I got on the plane, and I flew home. And the next morning, we said, right, we raised 10 million. Right? And we get out of the door, and we do this. The next morning, we started. And interestingly, two other companies did it at exactly the same time. And they did it in America. And actually, because the quantums of cash were better and they could do it faster, they did it better than us in the long run. But that was a trigger. That was seeing something and knowing that that's an opportunity.
Yeah, but you have to have all that expertise. You have to have all those resources available. And you have to wait and wait and wait until the penny drops. I mean, your thing about that thing about Paris reminds me. I gave Herman Hauser a lift back from a conference in Paris, probably about the same time. And we sat in the back of this taxi talking about things. And we were talking about the idea of having a stock market in Cambridge and the idea of actually starting to exchange shares.
That was not a good idea.
Well, it's an idea that time has not yet arrived. Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of problems with doing a stock market in Cambridge, one of which is what's fair value for somebody's shares, because everybody tries to blag their shares, and you have various rules for those. They're weaker on the AIM than they are on the main index, but they're still rules that you have to abide by. So that wasn't going to work, but we discussed the idea of doing share trading. And blow me down, by the time we got to the end of this, we were talking about electronic trading, because this is 93, 94. Analysis, as my consultancy company, was just making a transition to doing everything on the web. And I started to talk about how this would be a good idea. But I wasn't in a position to do anything about that. Dear old Herman went back, started a thing called E-Trade.
I made a lot of money.
And I don't know how many tens of millions he made out of that, but it was an awful lot. Now, he was in the right position. We'd had the right discussion. I just didn't have the resources to do it.
Big question.
Off he goes.
Big question. I don't know whose idea it was. It was probably both of your idea.
I think more Herman's than mine, to be honest.
Because my point on ideas are cheap is I'm an ideas person. I have loads of ideas, and I know other people have loads of ideas. Actually, I don't know what's a good idea and a bad idea until I've stress-tested it. So this whole thing of meeting and talking to people in taxis and in bars and in pubs as a way of validating what you're doing. And actually, the way it works for me now is when I have ideas, I have a set of people who I talk to. And actually, if the idea is a good idea, they jump on it. Not only do they jump on it, they start doing things on it. It starts evolving. They start doing... And my test now for one of my areas that's a good idea at the right time is whether people I know start doing it. Now, very often when that happens, and I've known a number of cases where that's happened, where actually people have taken that idea, done something, made a lot of money and done fairly well out of it, and I've effectively got very little. Do I worry with that? No, because an idea is valueless unless someone does something to it. And ideas are cheap, and if you're good at having ideas, you'll have lots of them, and it's about how they evolve and who does what with them, how people commit to them, that's important.
Yeah,
there's a man. There's a man, right? Let's talk about people a minute. Seamus is there. Let's talk about... Seamus is a man who has more ideas. And our real worry with Seamus...
He's made more money out of writing business plans than anybody I know.
He has. I invested in his company, Cambridge Temperature Concept, which is a great company, isn't it, Seamus? You're in Cambridge Temperature.
No, he's not.
He didn't go. And we'll ask the question why he's not in a minute, and he'll tell me I was an idiot. But it was a great idea. But the trouble with Seamus was, right, he had an idea in every. He had not just one idea in every business plan competition. He had three ideas in every business plan competition, and he stood up and talked passionately, equally passionately about all of them. And our real worry with Seamus was that actually if we gave him some money to do what he was doing, he wouldn't do it for very long and would race off with one of his other ideas. I have to say, we're all very impressed that either he has been able to focus or the rest of his team have been able to keep him focused.
Now, I wanted to, I mean, with the stress testing stuff, because one of the ways in which Cambridge Angels, for example, does stress testing, well, we do it in two ways. One is there's an informal pitching thing, and then there's the ultimate stress testing of getting two pitches before dinner, and then we sit down with a good bottle of Chateau de Châtelet, and then have a chat about what's going on. And there is something interesting about the way the dynamic works when you're talking about an idea and talking about the stress. Because if you've got 24 people sitting around, and they're not stupid, and they've seen a few of these things. We can talk names after this. They come up with stuff, criticisms or points about investments that you never thought of. You never would have thought of in a million years. And that's really the most important part about that stress testing.
And it's more valuable than you would imagine. So the people I really worry about, the people I feel sorry for, are the people who think they've had a brilliant idea. They think it's the idea, and they are so bloody precious about it. I cannot tell you because the idea is brilliant. If it's a brilliant idea, you've got to find a way of communicating it without giving away, you know, the secret. But actually, very few people really steal ideas. And you're better off if you've got it. You're much more successful having an idea, exposing people to it, right? Or exposing the idea to people, such that actually the idea evolves and you work out whether it's a good idea, rather than keeping it and saying, it's my brilliant idea and someday I'm going to do that. That's really sad.
So you've got to have the idea, you've got to have the timing, and you've got to have the resources. Now, Herman, I've already mentioned, you know, has this dictum. You know, we were lucky. We had two things going for us. We didn't have enough time, and we didn't have enough money. Now, there's a point about the resource, which is about you're in a state. In effect, I don't want to get too metaphysical about this or psychological, but you've got to be driven. I met a guy yesterday who's got a fabulous idea, which I can't tell you about, which I may well invest in. But I've been completely convinced by the fact that he's thought this thing through. He stress tested it. Its timing is good. He understands about the execution. But above all, there's this drive to actually make something really work. And if you're going to spot an opportunity, and I'm sitting here on the other side, as it were. I do things on the basis of people coming and having a chat with me and saying, that's all right, that's okay, come back in about 6 months, or, oh my God, can we talk next week? As I did, I mean, when I met Jonathan, for example, about
Abcam. We'll do Abcam in a minute, because it's a brilliant story.
CRFS, for example. Yeah. So Alistair Mazzarella came along to me with, I mean, he's a brilliant radio engineer, came along to me with this slide pack of about five ideas, four of which were pretty rubbish. And I was sitting at my kitchen table, and I still remember exactly where I was sitting. And I don't let anybody else flick through slide packs because I'm far too impatient. You know, I want to flick through and actually see this stuff. And I flicked through. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. You know, what am I doing here? And he came with one, which was this spectrum monitoring. And I went, holy cow, can you really do this? Can you really? Because what he'd done was he'd actually got a picture. He's a great salesman as well as being a great radio engineer. So he got a picture of this piece of kit as he thought he could do it. And I said, can you really do that? And he said, yes. And I said, what's the bomb cost on that? I'm not going to tell you what the bill of materials cost. There's how much the components cost to make. because I don't want you to know that we're making at least 98% gross margin on our products. like Abcam, I'll do that in a second. No, not 98%. Sorry, that was a mistake. And I went, this is it. Now, why did I know it was it? Well, because I'd been doing a lot of work on spectrum, so I knew that we were liberalising spectrum markets. I knew that there were a bunch of guys already in the market who got bits of kit that looked like, I don't know, traction engines or, you know, steam engines or something compared to this thing. And this thing was just changing the economics in the same way as the PC changed the economics of computing versus the mainframe. And that was it. It took me less than 2 seconds.
But if that presentation had come to you through an email, would you have spotted it?
Yeah. No. Exactly. I mean, probably no.
So there's another key thing here.
Yeah.
Ideas are cheap, but actually ideas that are attractive are usually attractive because the people who are with the idea.
And that's what this guy did yesterday about this idea that I can't tell you about. Because I actually took him out to lunch at Bocca di Lupo.
Yeah,
right?
Another one. Yeah, of course.
Okay. And I took him out, which is a restaurant. That...
Talking about not understanding things you invest in, this man's invested in a restaurant and still thinks it's a good deal.
Hang on a second, Andy. Hang on a second.
The Times
restaurant critic said of Bocca di Lupo, 9.67 out of 10... Have I ever given a restaurant as high a mark?
Doesn't
as this?
Mean you're going to get.
I don't think I ever have.
You don't know how exits work in restaurants.
Yeah, they do. After you paid the bill, you go straight out. It's all right. They're repaying my loan early. That's okay. So you see that kind of stuff. You see how that works. And the guy yesterday, for example, had that drive. But also, what he'd done, he produced the most fabulous slide pack I'd ever seen in my life. A complete design of the entire concept end to end. And it was so impressive. He clearly put his heart and soul into the whole thing.
But you're partly buying into him.
Yeah, I am. A lot.
A lot.
About 102%, actually.
And that's usually the way it works.
Yeah.
And so stuff that's logical, that works, that looks right, but doesn't have the people and the passion, just doesn't cut it. And it's usually people that make the trigger work.
Come on, we've got 6 or 7 minutes left.
So I'll give you a trigger. Can I just give you Arrakis?
Go on. So, exactly. I want to hear about Arrakis.
I want
to do a bad one as well.
So Cairo Science, which I told you about how it started, but how it actually suddenly jumped up, and it was a phenomenal company because it went through a big VC round, and then one of the first sort of public market flotations of a biotech company, and we did loads of deals. We got into genomics by buying a company off Bill Gates at a ridiculous price. We got products on the market, and eventually the company got sold to Celtech for $750 million, and was a great exit at the time. It was a great success story. Had a large number of people employed. A lot of people made money on the public market, investors and employees, and it was great. But it came to an end because we sold it because that was the right time in the cycle. And out of that, a bunch of us started. One of the things that's really interesting when companies—it's a very important time when companies get sold, stop, finish. Loads of leaving parties. People sitting in pubs, reminiscing about the old days, Josiah. And that's a very reflective time. And there were a bunch of us who started meeting at leaving parties to say, there was something we were doing for a while that was really, really smart. And we couldn't work out what it was. So we used to meet, four of us occasionally. One of us occasionally didn't turn up. At my place for a pizza and a glass of wine, and then bring a curry and a glass of wine. We used to meet at least once a week, and we used to sit there. And it took us 6 months to work out what we were doing at a particular time in the past that was really clever that we could do again, and why it was the right time to do it. That became Arrakis. But actually, Arrakis could have remained a curry and wine business.
Yeah.
For years. And know those business plans. Those things that people have talked about for years and years and years. Until just after Christmas, 2000, Julian Gilbert, who was one of the guys who was doing this, walked in to our session with curry and everything, and he put an envelope on the table. Right? And we sat there, and we had our curry, and we had our wine, and we talked, and we were selecting which was our great products. And at the end of the curry and wine session, he picked the envelope up, and he said, "Do you know what this is, guys?" And we said, "No." He said, "It's my resignation. Tomorrow, I hand my notice in the company I am, because I'm going to do this. Are you guys with me or not?" That was a trigger, and that was someone who understood how to play triggers. And of course, we were with him, and the company happened, and it was successful, and we sold it for $100 million a few years later. And okay, it probably wasn't as big as it could have been because of the financing climate, but it was triggered, and it was triggered by an individual doing something that understood how things start. And if you're going to get into businesses and get investment and build teams, you've got to understand this process of pulling and sucking people in and then making something happen.
So I think we're really going to sum up here, I think. I mean, there's loads of other stuff we could...
Oh, we're going to do AbCam. No, do AbCam. Tell us what the trigger on AbCam was. Tell us what the trigger was, because that's fascinating.
2 minutes on AbCam. So
this is the thing that galls me, because he's made more money out of biotech than I have because of AbCam.
Okay.
Which was a dumb idea. No, it wasn't a dumb idea. I would have thought at the time it was a dumb idea.
when we floated, one of the potential investment funds said that he'd done his PhD in biochemistry and had thought about doing exactly the same thing. And had done the business plan calculations and decided it wouldn't work. Mm. So I thought that's quite amusing. AbCam's, we're about market cap, about
300 million.
Just a bit over 300 million. Anyway, so AbCam started in exactly the following way. And rather amusingly, I dug up all the emails from the first exchanges between me and Jonathan.
What, for this meeting?
Actually, I've just stepped down as chairman of AbCam.
A bit scared that they were prepared.
They had a really nice leaving do for me Friday a week ago. And so as part of that, I had to give a little speech. So I actually dug up all the old emails, which I tend to keep this stuff. So it was very... we've only got, as Shai said, 2 minutes, and that was about 2 minutes ago. So let me just tell you. So my wife and Rosie, who's now Jonathan's wife, were working at an art gallery, and there was a Christmas dinner. And because the run-up to Christmas is a bit busy, we actually had this Christmas dinner about the 20th of January, 20th of January, 1998. And Jonathan and I were sitting towards one end of the table, and of course they were talking about art and all the other stuff that they knew about. And so I was asking Jonathan what he did. He's a postdoc, and he was going to finish that June, July. So I said, "What are you going to do?" Because I'm quite interested in people's careers. And he said, "Well, I'm thinking about selling antibodies because there's this company called Santa Cruz that I hate with a passion, sells antibodies in absolute rubbish. And I really think I could do better than that. We can make some antibodies and do better." And we had a discussion in which it was clear, and Jonathan will say this, I mean, he didn't actually know about the economics of this stuff. This is what happens when
he... didn't know much about businesses.
He didn't know a bit about... Not that much about... Well, he's a postdoc, so, I mean, it was kind of... So the conversation went roughly like this. I mean, how do these antibodies work? Well, I know how antibodies work. I know about that stuff. But basically, how do you get antibodies out of an animal? Well, you inject them with a peptide, and then in a mammal you wait 72 days, and then you can do various bleeds, and then you purify it and take off the antibodies. And if you've got a goat, for example, a goat's a good model for this stuff, because they tend to produce a lot of antibody, and you can get around about 500 aliquots, which... is a dose. Well, it's not a dose, actually. It's good enough for about 5 or 10 experiments. Out of 500 of these aliquots out of a goat. So, Jonathan, how much did it cost to do a goat? So you had to think for a moment, because, of course, you do this stuff in the lab where you go out and make antibodies. It costs you about £1,500 to do a goat in the antibody sense. And then the... And then I asked, well, how many aliquots do you get out of this goat? And it was about 500. So despite having had some chateau de Chasselet, I could work out this was £3 and aliquot. And then I said, well, how much do you sell them for? And the answer was 150 quid. Now, 147 pound gross margin on a 150 pound product is a pretty good deal. I mean, that's almost as good as CRFS. So the then I said, I remember stopping for a moment, and I sort of thought, a bit like those, you know the joke about the economist walking down the street and one says there's a £20 note on the pavement and the other one says there can't be because the market would have cleared it by now, right? And I thought, why is this opportunity sitting here? So I said, and actually the hairs are still going up on the back of my head, you know, as I say this. There's a problem. There must be a problem with this. You can't ship this stuff out of the lab because it's dangerous. And Jonathan went, oh, no, you can put it in the post and send it, survive 3 or 4 days. And I went, that means you can sell it over the web. He went, yeah, that's right. We'd had a bit of trouble with exchanging emails, but the following Saturday he was in my office at analysis. By the time we got to, that was January.
January 1998.
So by March, we'd chosen the name. By October, we got the website up and running, and we were selling our first product.
But this is dot-com boom.
Oh, yeah, but
this
nobody...
Is a, yeah, no, no, yeah, this, no, is, yeah, this dot-com is dot-com boom. This was perfect, right? Because actually, the people who wanted to buy on the web were people who would go on the web and could find out the information on the web. Whereas at that time, the thing I was seeing and I was feeling, oh my God, I'm missing, was that everyone, you name something retail and everyone was setting up companies to sell it on the web. And most were bonkers.
Yeah, yeah.
We're basket cases because actually they didn't scale, they didn't work. But this one did.
And the reason why it scaled... was that, going back to the resources at the time, and we really will finish shy, the resources at the time, I'd built analysis with all its IT systems, so all those IT systems and all that web stuff went into AmpCam. And the managing director, chief operating officer at AmpCam is Jim Warwick, who was my head of IT at analysis. Go on, we've got to stop.
Right, we're going to stop. So, guys, now we've got some questions. Yeah?